Yeah. So we're talking about the idea of the truth behind the mask, right? So what's intended by that is fairly obvious when it comes to Purim, which is the notion that Purim is a celebration of discovering the hidden, the whole idea of discovering the hidden. And this is really the Jewish role in the world itself. Now, the way we know that Purim really is a holiday which the very celebrations of the holiday themselves cause us to be hidden from the essence of the holiday. It's really interesting. In other words, other holidays, you have rituals and practices, and they point you in the direction of the meaning of the holiday. So, for example, in Rosh Hashanah, you sound the shofar. It doesn't distract you from what Rosh Hashanah is. The shofar expresses the royalty, the coronation, the herald, Messiah, creation of the world, giving of the Torah. That's the shofar. You just hear it, and you can hear all those things, and that's what Rosh Hashanah is all about, as an example. On Purim, so you have drinking. You're supposed to drink on Purim. Okay? Great. Okay. On Purim, you have the idea of costumes, which is not on the same level as drinking, halachically, but the idea of wearing costumes. So you get guys dressing up as Santa Claus, and rabbis trying to look cool, dressing up as some kind of who knows what. Okay. Okay, that's really funny. And you have a lot of merrymaking, and you have gramen, and you even have, you know, the idea of giving food to each other. And even the story of reading the Megillah is this story of there's a bad guy, and he was really bad. And he was so bad that he wanted to even kill women and children. And he got hung on his own tree. Wow. So God saved the Jews. Let's go eat. The whole story again. But you don't really have, in the rituals of Purim, you don't really have the access to the story of Purim, to what Purim really is about. Because Purim, I would submit, is the single day of the entire Jewish year that celebrates why there are Jews in the world. Why there are Jews in the world. As a matter of fact, there is a Medrash that says that when all the other holidays are no longer relevant in the era of the Mashiach, Purim will still be celebrated. So it's crazy. Like, why, of all things, we see it as a quote-unquote minor holiday. So what's the deal with Purim? Why is Purim so significant? So the answer is, as I just said, because Purim is the celebration of the reason for an existence of a human being. And the Jew stands for what it is to be a human being. And a human being's job is to take a world which is built specifically to hide the existence of God to a significant degree and to trace back to the Creator through that world which is designed to hide the existence of God. So let's go back to the beginning. So we have a Creator who, for reasons that will defy understanding, no matter what we say, all we'll do is push back the question a little bit more. But when, after all is said and done, we're never going to get to why He created the world. We're going to say because He wanted to have a world to give to. And then we're going to say, why does He want to give to the world? So we'll say, because that's His nature. So why is it His nature? It doesn't matter. It's just like, philosophically, we're in the same endless problem that we have in mathematics, and we have, you know, with the concept of infinity and the concept of a universe that either has no end or a universe that is defined. So we say, okay, where's the end of the universe? Wherever it is, what's on the other side? You know, we just can't conceptually wrap our minds around these things. But so God creates a world. By definition, the act of creation, and this is a Kabbalah talks about this all the time, by definition, the act of creation requires God to remove Himself from apparency. And this is very similar to how we would appreciate the distance of the earth from the sun. So the sun is the source of the earth, the source of life, the source of energy, the source of warmth, the source of photosynthesis. The sun is actually causes evaporation, which causes rain, which causes irrigation around the world. The sun is it's everything. And so the sun is our source. But we know that if the earth were to be positioned a couple million miles closer to the sun, we would, whatever we're worried about in greenhouse gases would be a trivial concern compared to what would happen if the earth can't be closer to its source than it is. Similarly, in a spiritual realm, God cannot overwhelm his creation with his own existence for several reasons. One is that he would incinerate it. It would so overwhelm it in that spiritual realm that there'd be no independence. There'd be no creation. Creation, by definition, is I create an entity which, to some degree, is separate and automatic and distant and not attached and totally dependent on me. There's no reason to create. It's impossible to create without this tzimtzum that Kabbalah talks about, this withdrawal. And so, by definition, God is, to a significant degree, hidden. And that's why the word in Hebrew for creation is, for the world, for the universe, is olam. Olam comes from the Hebrew word he'elam, which means hiddenness. The word for universe is ne'elam, same exact three words, ayin, lamed, mem, which is hidden, because the existence of the universe depends on the hiddenness of the Creator itself.
So when Moshe said to Hashem, show me who you are, show me your face.
I already know, right.
And he said, what did he say? Maybe the back, or maybe
he says, Ki lo yirani adam l'chai, nobody can see me and live. And so, V'ra'isas acharai v'upanai lo yirau. You'll see my from behind, but not from right. Which means you'll only see evidence that I was there. You can't get me straight. Right. It's overwhelming. Right. And that's the whole, actually, thank you, because you're, maybe that's what you mean. But the point is, why can't anybody see me and live? Because by definition, living means having some existence that at least appears to be independent from me. And as soon as you get fully who I am, you're finished, because you have no independent existence.
And the people who witnessed the giving of the Torah were not even at a level where they could see Moshe's face. He had to veil his face for those people.
That's right. Which, of course, was after the ego. They might have been able to gaze at it before. But of course, that the but they also were worried about this. There is a medrash that talks about them kind of like losing their neshama at the moment of the giving of the Torah. So there was some kind of an altered existence that perhaps we can't even relate to, that came as a result of this close encounter, that evidently was necessary for revelation. But they immediately sensed that they would die, and they asked, please, don't do this. So they feel like they're losing. That, and by the way, that's always a struggle. That really is that is a religious struggle. A religious struggle is right, because the second, if you really get who HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, you can't stand it. The part of you that existed before you understood what he is wants to go the other way. So then you pull the other way. As soon as you pull the other way, you go down a level. So there's this constant struggle. It's a very difficult thing. But that's the whole point. So therefore, the world is created based on hiddenness. So it comes along God and says, okay, I'm putting you, man, in charge of discovering the source, because the world will devolve into meaninglessness unless there is this coordinator and conductor who constantly points out the relevance of everything in the world to God as creator. So that's okay. So then we know the story. Adam fails at this, and tries to create a world that where it looks like he's independent. That's the whole idea of the tree of knowledge. Is I'm going to figure this out myself, right? I'm going to figure this out myself. I don't want to be so aware of you that I don't even have the option of doing the wrong thing. I want to be familiar with all options and then make a decision, right? He's not really crazy. He's not really sinful. In a certain sense, it's a miscalculation of a very healthy paradigm, which is that service of a Kadosh Baruch Hu does depend to a significant degree on distance. So Adam sins, but he uses his own rationale, which he's not supposed to do, to create this paradigm, and so therefore he's more distant from God. And then humanity starts devolving away from this whole awareness. God has to then readjust. Finally we get, finally we get to Avraham Avinu, who is revolutionary, because he's got this idea. Hey guys, I have a new idea. There's one creator. He's responsible for all this. This is something you never thought of. We started with Adam HaRishon, who was created literally by God's hand, who has no parents, who knows that he came from nothing other than God's act of creation. And we're now at a place where Avraham Avinu is this revolutionary who is teaching the world about this new concept that there's one creator in the world who's coordinating everything. Yesh Bira Below Binyan, is there a building, is there a castle, without a manager, without a director? Obviously everything that's going on here has got one director. It's not like you think that there are different powers. So Avraham Avinu is now trying to reveal what's going on behind. So that's the movement of the Jewish people. That's what we're doing. So therefore Purim, which celebrates a miracle which is not open, it's not just that it happened to be that on Purim we have this miracle where we successfully saw behind the veil and we figured out that God, we thank God for things that happened, it looked natural, you know, it was a 9-year story, the Megillah is a 9-year story, and the Megillah helps us appreciate that these things all happened in tandem and in sequence in such a way for the Jews to be saved. But of course as you're living through it, you don't have that perspective, and it's very easy not to see the hand of God and a relationship between the beginning of the Megillah and the end of the Megillah. You don't see that until you read through the perspective of the victorious Jew who repented and saw God coordinating everything. So the Megillah is not a story of we happen to see God in all this, and so therefore we celebrate that we see God. The whole point of Purim is that our salvation comes by exercising the very characteristic which is the rationale for the existence of the Jew in the first place. Meaning that our enemy, Amalek, is devoted passionately to the idea that there is nothing up there, there is no cause, there's no rhyme and reason, there's no rationale, there's no anything. And that's Amalek's philosophy. They're devoted to it. It's not that they happen to just, they didn't go to Hebrew school. This is what they believe. They actually believe this. And so they stand in contradistinction to the children of Israel who are put into the world just for this. And Amalek is put into the world just to accentuate the polar opposite so that we can play off of them and develop that muscle out of them. So the Purim story is really the polar opposite of the purpose of creation is Amalek, and the Jewish people are therefore victimized by Amalek in order for us to develop powerfully that muscle which we have to develop in order to be what we are for the world. And so that's the whole idea of Purim. So Purim is not this accidental thing that just happened to happen that way. So it's very natural that the rituals of Purim themselves will be such that they look like one thing, but they're really something else. They look like it's just, you know, groggers and merrymaking and party hats and masks and dancing around and Purim festivals.
It's not serious.
Right, exactly. It's a children's holiday, and you have to be able to, and the only way you can enjoy it is if you get drunk and so on and so forth. But the whole idea is that even the very observance of Purim is going to be an observance that requires a person to look behind the mask. And to see what's really going on. And so Purim looks like a trivial festival, and the truth is that Purim is definitive of the Jewish experience. And so the drunkenness is, for example, the whole idea of the power of wine to express that which is inside. Right, nichnas yayin yatzaso, that wine has the power to express the inside of a human being. Yayin yisamach levav adam, yayin levav adam, yayin brings joy to the heart of a person, which means that wine is a special commodity because it's also a commodity which, through human intervention, is transformed. It great becomes very powerful and effective. So wine actually goes inside and brings out that which is inside. That's the whole idea. So by getting drunk, so to speak, we're having access to the true core of what it is to be a Jew. And we don't, just the opposite. We're peeling away the costume. Because all year long we walk around with the logical, super cool, intellectual, I'm not a sucker for faith kind of an attitude. And then comes Purim, and we just get rid of all that, and we go back to what we are on the inside. That's the wine thing. And the costume, of course, is just like you're going to look behind me to figure out who I really am. That's what I do in life, is to look behind the world to find out who God really is. That's my mission in life. All of life is a costume, and we have to become experts at looking behind the costume. And By the way, why is unity such a big thing in Purim? Why is unity such a big thing in Purim? Mishloach manos ish l'reyeyu matal manos l'avyonim. Sending gifts one to another and gifts to the poor. That's really, why did the Jews in Shushan do that? In other words, good, they had a wonderful thing. We were all in trouble, we were all going to die, and then we're saved, and we're really happy. So I even understand more gifts to each other. But what did the poor have to do with it? What's this whole business? Why is that an important part of Purim? So I think here, this is a very important point because it speaks to what makes unity. What is the source of unity? And the Jews understood that it is impossible to be committed to what it is to be a Jew without being united with the other. Not without being united. Not that unity is necessary. I mean something else. Unity is a natural byproduct. It's just like, you know, you throw atoms together and you get a certain nuclear byproduct, waste product, and that stuff is just, it's just there. It just happens. Unity just happens when you get why it is that you exist as a Jew. Because the second you get that, you're no longer focused on physical achievement as a defining aspect of your existence. The second you get that, you're no longer focused on physical pleasure. The second you understand why Jews exist in the world, you understand that there's a mission that spans history and that's worth giving your life for. And as soon as you're defined by something, by that sense of mission, there's unity. Unity comes when you are not worried about yourself. The second you're not worried about yourself, you can be unified with anybody else who shares that purpose. Anytime there's a calling, and the truth is you can have unity for evil as well. Unity will happen in evil as well. There is nothing, and by the way, the human organism, there is nothing as thrilling as being unified with other human beings. We love it when we feel that unity.
Baseball stadium.
Right. My God, exactly. It is unbelievable. It's an unbelievable feeling. I remember when Cabrera got the single in the bottom of the ninth in the seventh game of the playoffs against the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I was there.
You were there.
And I was there. And what I loved at that moment was that I and the black fans who I was leaning against were like, we were in love.
That's
we were
right.
in love. You're there was
right.
nothing that separated us at that moment. We were in absolute, me, George Galinsky, and the black fans around us, we were in total love. And I didn't care if you were George Galinsky or the guy who wrote Eros. Everything, because we were, that's all we cared about at that moment. That was it, right? And Nazi Germany?
That's right.
Oh my gosh, it's intoxicating. And because you're lost in a bigger cause. That's the whole point. So the point is that the Jews, there's always unity when we're lost in the cause of why we exist as a people. And as soon as we lose that, we're stuck with ourselves. And I am definitely more important than you. Okay, that's it. I'm more important than you. So as long as if I'm not living for what same thing that you're living for, so then I don't feel any connection to you. There can't be any unity if we're not devoted to God. There can't be any unity. All the talk of unity is just unity always. If you're not talking about devotion to God, anytime you're talking about unity, you're saying everybody should be like me. That's what it means. And that's never unity because everybody else wants you to be like them. So it's not unity.
You can't be unified outside of God and outside of yourself?
No, I don't believe so. No. You could be unified outside of yourself. But when you're a Jew, and since your reason of existence is God, when you move away from that, the only thing left is going to be my own will. Because, you know, and once it's my own will, it could be any cause you want. I'm for poverty. I'm for solving poverty.
Right.
But that I've now redefined my existence. So now you've got your idea, you're a socialist, you're a liberal, you're an environmentalist, you're a stuck-up person. But the point is that we've moved off of what calls us as a people. So I think that's why unity is a major issue on Purim. That's why, because it's kimu v'kibul, they accepted their commitment to what they... To what they defines them as a people. So yeah, if everybody was for poverty, right, so then we'd be unified that way. The problem is that since that's not what defines us, right, therefore we're never going to get everybody. What defines us, we are brought into the world really to uncover the existence of God. So that's the thing that's going to define us. It's either that or we're going to make up other things. Once we make up other things...
Israel's threatened and the whole community would bind together and
and support Israel, then there would be a unity.
Yeah, but by the way, even that, there's an illusion of unity. It's not even true, because at the same time, you've got other Jews who are saying Israel's at fault.
Right.
They're the
yeah.
one, you know, of course you're threatened, because you're evil. The Zionists are imperialist aggressors. We have Jews who believe that.
Right.
Yeah, so there is no such thing. The only unity the Jews ever have is under God. We have illusions of unity. We have causes that unite us. When we're under attack, you're right, there's a war, all of a sudden lots of people give money and they go to Israel and stuff like that. But by the way, in 1973, in the Yom Kippur War, so they raised more money than ever in UJA for Israel in that October of 73. And two-thirds of the Jewish people didn't give a dime.
Really?
Okay, that was the highest rate of threat, and the highest rate of giving, and two-thirds of the Jewish
worldwide.
I think it's American Jews.
Yeah,
meaning, you have unified those who are already connected. But
yeah.
I'm just saying, two-thirds did nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two-thirds.
So to go back to the mask, is the mask to show that it's always a mask?
Right.
The
world itself is a mask.
World mask. That's what I had in the book. World mask.
Is it?
Series.
Rabbi Tanz. Uh-huh. I was in London. I was in London 3 weeks ago. I heard him speak. Rabbi Tanz.
Amazing.
For MD. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's only. By the way, he's on the internet. All of his stuff is
really?
On the internet. Free. Yeah.
His new stuff I have for sale. A lot of the stuff that you find on the internet is the old stuff, and you can also order the new stuff on the internet.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The old stuff is free posted.
He's got a lot of stuff.
We were talking earlier about Esther and Hester. It's fascinating how Purim is about covering and mist and discovery. And
right.
Mist, you know,
right.
So it's really a much deeper. It's very interesting what you said. It's much deeper than everybody's getting drunk and selling hot dogs and wearing
And Rabbi Katz quotes another source says that we should all write a Megillah of our own life.
What does that mean?
That you don't. It looks like things like a piece of tapestry viewed from the back appears to be not with threads tangled hopelessly. But when you get to the end of the Megillah of your own life, you look around, you see that you were looking at the wrong side of the tapestry.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And then you look at the right side, it's a beautiful picture. But you can't see that from the back.
I mean, everyone's life is like a Megillah.
Yes.
Right, you can't really see.
You don't see the pattern until at the end.
The end.
That's why he says you should document the different things. And Rabbi Cordozo gives an excellent lecture on 613 that hard.
You've got him a few times.
The whole idea of Megillus Esther and how everything in our life is Hashkacha Pratis. And he gives this incredible story that has you bound to your seat, how these two men met on this train going up to Tel Aviv, and they shouldn't have been on this train because his daughter had this school play, and the school play was supposed to happen the last week, but it didn't happen last week because the person, the star
high school
star of this show got sick, so they had to delay it a week. They go through all these scenarios, and then there was an accident on the other side of the road, upside down, so the guy had to take a shortcut, and he drove past his house and gave him a ride and all this other stuff, and this one lady was sitting in the train room, and she was yak about her daughter's birthday and how she loved her daughter's birthday and all this other stuff. Why was this daughter born this day? Well, the fact is she shouldn't have been born this day because 30 years ago when she was born, the doctor did a blood pressure test and found out that the woman had high blood pressure, and rather than risk complications, he decided to take the baby early. Had the baby not been taken early, that woman that would not have been on that train at that time and all these things would not have come to pass. And it's just mind-boggling when you stop to think about it.
How did Purim become a minor, quote, minor holiday? Why? Why do we allow it?
It's not a minor. Yeah, it's a rabbinic holiday. Because we are generally illiterate in Jewish thought. It's part of our exile experience, by the way. Part of our exile experience is the loss of this awareness. And finally, Purim is going to become obscure because that's the avoda of Purim, is actually to see through things. So Purim has, that's why I'm suggesting that Purim actually has built into it the power of obscuritanism. And And that's why, just the opposite, you're not going to get Purim easily. Purim requires work, because the whole point of Purim is this paradigm of seeing behind it. So it's going to be hidden. Purim doesn't give you easy access to it. Yom Kippur doesn't require anything, right? Yom Kippur does not require a lot of work.
Easy to connect to Yom Kippur.
Right,
self-evident is just there.
Yeah. Right. You know, you just fast and hang around with other Jews, and you know, 1 out of 10 viduis is probably going to connect to you. No, seriously, that's not the avodah of Purim is not to see through something. There's other work on Purim that doesn't come easy, but not that. You know. That's why Purim is Yom Kippur is called Yom Kippurim. That's what they
say. Yeah, it's a day like Yom.
Yeah, day like Yom, like Purim.
A day
Purim,
like Purim.
Yeah. Anyway.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being here and helping me.